Welcome back to the Bob Davis Podcasts. This time live in southeastern Arizona. I'm out of Phoenix. In this podcast, I'm going to talk about my visit today to a place called Casa Grande. It's a ruin just south of Phoenix on the road to Tucson, Arizona, in podcast 565. So traveling in the Southwest, it still feels like summer out here. It's beautiful and it's amazing. It's 90 and 100 degrees in the desert, 70 and 80 degrees up in the hills and the mountains, and it's wonderful. And of course, I know back in the Twin Cities, it's 45 degrees, it's raining, there's talk of snow, or it's already snowed in some places. And of course, some people have not had their heating checked for winter. And, you really ought to get that done. And of course, you can call Ryan Plumbing and Heating in St. Paul for a heating check. Of course, Ryan Plumbing and Heating of St. Paul is number one for keeping these systems running right, especially at home or your business, whether it's plumbing or heating this time of the year. Call Ryan Plumbing in St. Paul, 651-224-4771, in Minneapolis, 612-927-6488. Of course, Ryan goes back four generations in St. Paul. What do they do? Quality replacement and repair of all plumbing, heating, and air conditioning systems, residential and business. When they come out and check your heating, ask them about improving the efficiency of your heating system for home or business, as well as what they can do to save you some money on water usage. And you should ask them, and you're probably not going to do it, but it's expensive. If you've got the cash, it can save you a lot of money. And this, of course, is high efficiency heat. 651-224-4771 in St. Paul, in Minneapolis, 612-927-6488, online at ryanplumbing.com. They also do great emergency service, residential and business. One more time, 651-224-4771 in St. Paul, in Minneapolis, 612-927-6488. Metro-wide means the suburbs too. For over 60 years, Ryan Plumbing and Heating of St. Paul. So I had a great visit in Phoenix, and I rolled out of Phoenix at midday today after stopping at the Whole Foods and the Trader Joe's for various things, more beef jerky and macadamia nuts, and a boatload of water because I was heading out to the desert. And that means meandering east-southeast, first on the 10 east and then on some back roads, which are stunning, which I'll talk about at some point in the podcast. And my plan at this point is to spend some time in New Mexico. Part of it is I really don't want to go home. The previous podcast was about that. I really don't want to go home at all. I just want to keep out here, and it's so wonderful. So I'm going to meander through southeastern Arizona and New Mexico, but I am right down near the border in southeastern Arizona, and I've stopped for the night in a place called Tombstone, Arizona. And I will just quickly tell you, as a travel log, the first thing that you see out here, now, you might recall when, if you listen to the Pipeline Protest podcast, you hear me talking about the National Guard checkpoints. They have border guard checkpoints here, and they're very, very similar to the National Guard checkpoints, where you're kind of in a position where you have to stop. And there's some time away from the border. There are a few, I'd say, at least maybe 100 miles or less from the border. So it's really interesting. You see a lot of border police riding up and down the highways. And I'm on two lane roads, 90, 82, 84, and these different highways in Arizona, which are spectacular and beautiful. And I'll talk about that in the future. But I'm here in Tombstone, Arizona. Of course, Tombstone is the site of the famous gunfight at the OK Corral, where the legend of Wyatt Earp was born. Now, he was legendary by the time he came here to Tombstone, but I would say that the legend of Wyatt Earp, and I've talked about, I haven't done as many podcasts about the Old West as I have about gangsters, Bonnie and Clyde and Dillinger and people like that. But you come out here, and this is, interestingly enough, this is the history of the outlaws and people like that. And much of it is myth. And much of it was born with the gunfight at the OK Corral and the legend of Wyatt Earp. It is perhaps the legend of the West and the best capsulization of that myth is probably the movie High Noon with Gary Cooper, right? You would come to know this myth if you watched a lot of TV Westerns, if you grew up watching TV Westerns on television back in the day. If you are too young, if you never watched Westerns, let me just put it to you this way. It is arguable that today's modern science fiction is simply an adaptation of the Western myth, which is basically one man reluctantly standing up alone against evil. So this is the myth that was created, and it has really colored our view of the American West in many, many ways, both in terms of defining the Indians incorrectly and defining settlers incorrectly and defining the old Western town incorrectly. So it's very, very interesting. And I just rolled in here, and I'm at the RV park right inside Tombstone, and I'll be here, and so I'm gonna walk a couple blocks into downtown Tombstone tomorrow, and I will be rolling, so we'll get some audio. But don't laugh, because it's a powerful myth, and it's been used more than once in our political history. It is actually deep in the psyche of the American people, this myth of the American West. But there were other people here too, native people. They might actually call them ancestral people. Long before white men ever came here, they flourished in this region to the west and north of here, all the way from all the way through the Sonora Desert, and they probably became significant as a population around the 10th and 9th centuries on through the early 1400s, but it might have actually been earlier. They really don't know. And then they dispersed inexplicably in the 1400s, the mid-1400s, and people really don't know why. This is why history is fascinating to me, because you hear so much in America that, especially from Europeans, well, you know, we have things that are 700 and 800 and 900 years old, and you don't have anything like that. Well, we do, but it's just not European. It's not settler history. It's Native American history. It's ancestral people history. And it's much older than anything in the United States, and in some cases older than the stuff in Europe. So I think that's very interesting. And these were, of course, ancestors to many of the people who now populate or are part of the Indian tribes all over America. But this particular group, I think I'm going to mispronounce it, but I think it's the Hohokam. They would be ancestors to many of the Indian tribes in the Southwest today. They were hunter-gatherers, and they eventually must have had some sort of technical or intellectual revolution, because they eventually started congregating into villages along the Salt River and the Gila River Valley, where they started to farm. Now, this is fascinating, because they were doing this, you know, in the 9th century, and what they were doing was they were irrigating. And if you travel the Southwest, particularly this region, it's dry. I mean, it's a desert, and you will see, you know, the river irrigation from those same rivers all over this area, where they are irrigating vast tracts of land. I passed a beautiful green field of corn. It made me think it was June in the Midwest, but it's October down here in the Southwest, and they got a full crop of corn that was just massive. They grow cotton, they have wineries, all sorts of things, and this is all because of irrigation. Well, these people were doing this in the 1000s and 1100s all along these valleys, and they did it all the way out to California. They traded with other tribes. Well, I wouldn't even call them tribes. They were groups, they were societies, or whatever you want to call them. All the way out to California, all the way down to Mexico. So I think it's fair that they were pretty advanced, or somehow they had communication with Aztecs or Incas, and they acquired some of the knowledge that they were using, both about the same time and perhaps a little before or a little after. I'm a little foggy on my Aztec and Inca histories. They built things on platform mounds, not as dramatic as the ones in South America, but basically these are foundations built of a mixture of sand and clay and limestone, so it's like concrete. They built, on this particular Casa Grande site, there is a what they thought was a basically a ball field, where you descend into it. They had houses, and they lived in houses, and they were domesticated. Basically, they were gatherers, and they were engaged in the act of farming. And of course, they built the houses, walls, you know, and everything else out of this same mixture. And of course, this place called Casa Grande is made out of this. Now, Casa Grande was named by a Spanish missionary. The people there did not call it Casa Grande. Nobody knows what they call it. So remember that the mounds and buildings like Casa Grande probably had some ritual and spiritual purposes as well, although there are different theories about that. Some people think Casa Grande was simply some sort of royal palace. Others think that it had, some utilitarian purpose. It is 4 stories high. It's pretty impressive, even though it's a ruin today. They don't know what it was for. As I said, they have lots of different theories. But here's some interesting stuff. Its walls face the 4 cardinal points of the compass. There are circular holes at the top in the back, and they align with the setting sun at summer solstice. But it's really interesting because other openings align with the sun and moon at specific times. One of them is a moon cycle that occurs every 18 years, and this little hole is built specifically for that. And so it has some sort of, implications like Stonehenge, you know, which we also really don't know what they use that for. So you see people that you didn't think were very similar to, let's say, the Europeans or the Celts, in some ways are. They built the same kinds of structures to do similar things, perhaps. Now, I've toured some of the sites out here over the years. I've climbed up on some incredible mounds. This time I just visited Casa Grande and then I headed out because it was actually pretty late this afternoon and I wanted to get up here because I want to go into New Mexico and the national forests in New Mexico during the day. I don't want to miss that. And I kind of want to be bivouacked by sunset, either in a state park someplace or at one of these cool old RV parks where you meet really cool old people who know all kinds of things. And I'll tell you about that perhaps if I have time in this podcast about, well, I'll just tell you right now. So I met the lady that runs this RV park who was nice enough to let me stay here tonight. And she told me, this is the interesting thing about Tombstone. If you've seen the movie Tombstone, you always wonder how those people survived with all that clothing on. And I thought that was a mistake in the context of the movie Tombstone, which everybody knows about because it's probably the most accurate portrayal of the Wyatt Earp story. But I found out something about Tombstone. Tombstone has a very pleasant climate. It is not as hot as even 100 miles away. It never gets as hot as it does down in Phoenix or down in that desert I was in today. And the nights are actually kind of chilly. So it's really cool. And I think part of it is the altitude. You climb, I don't know how many thousand feet to get up here. So it's just a kind of a pleasant place. So when you see the movie Tombstone and you see them wearing the dusters and you see them wearing all those clothes, well, you know that that probably made some sense considering the climate here. So back down to the desert with Casa Grande. The climate back in those days wasn't that different than it is today. So life in that desert, the Sonora Desert, wasn't very hospitable. And of course, it is, though, if you know what you're doing. Of course, they had irrigation and they had farming, but they also knew how to, harvest the natural plants growing out there, different types of cacti and whatever. And they'd been able to master irrigation down to determining these seasons for planting and harvesting. So there was a fair amount of technology that they had mastered considering the time that they lived in. And I'll tell you what, I looked at the pottery and some of the artifacts they have in cases at the visitor center there, and they are really amazing. Now, I'm not an expert on archaeology. I couldn't tell you the difference between Ming Dynasty pottery and the artwork of these people, but they're pretty intricate and they're pretty beautiful. And I don't know if you'd call them a primitive people or not. When you look at what they did, you're like, you know what? This is pretty fine work. This is artistic. This is art. This isn't just utility. So you'll have to draw your own conclusions if you ever come out to Casa Grande. You take I-10 east from Phoenix, or you take it west from wherever you're coming from. You're going to see signs for Casa Grande Monument. If you're coming out of Phoenix, 20 or so exits down, about 30 miles from Tucson, you do not want to go to the town of Casa Grande. You want to go to the monument. So you take that exit, and then you're going to drive about 15 miles when you get close, you're going to see the outdoor roof that covers the ruins, and that actually protects the ruins of Casa Grande from the sun, and then the park is right there. Well, I got to say that Mobile Podcast Command is really performing beautifully. It's kicking butt, to say the least. So this is a 2000 Ford 450 Super Duty ambulance, and I've driven it all the way from Minnesota, all the way out to Seattle, down those, up and down those mountain roads, up and down the PCH by the beaches, and you know all about that, across the mountains, through the desert to Phoenix, and now, of course, I'm in southeastern Arizona by the border. So it's heat, it's cold, it's rain, and this thing just keeps on trucking. And, you know, it's funny because people always tell me, oh, it's a diesel. You know, they use a lot of oil. And so I decided I got an oil change before I left Minneapolis. And, you know, it's been 1,500 or so miles. And so I thought I better check the oil. And it was down only a little bit. So I went and got some oil. It is running like a top. And, of course, Mobile Podcast Command came from xgovernmentcars.com. Now, xgovernmentcars.com is Minnesota's only dealer specializing in one-owner, professionally maintained government fleet cars, trucks, and SUVs. If you need a car or a work truck, if you need a loan and you have a job, you can get approved. They take trades. They pay the highest values all the time without a bunch of BS. And also, don't forget the 3-day love it guarantee. If you have some kind of problem, you take it back exclusively at X Government Cars. So here's what you do. Get your butt down to xgovernmentcars.com, now open in Golden Valley at 2420 Nevada Avenue North. You can call them at 763-777-8782. They got the Dodge Chargers, the Ford Police SUVs, which are super cool because they have a 4-inch lower profile than all of the normal Explorers. So they're super stealthy and cool. And of course, they have the Ford Police sedan, which is a great car, and the Chevy Impala V8 and Crown Vicks. While they last, I've had 3 Crown Vicks, so I love them. And yes, the Dodge Chargers as well. Again, xgovernmentcars.com. Get your butt down to X Government Cars at 2420 Nevada Avenue North in Golden Valley, 763-777-8782. Let me split the night air in Tombstone, Arizona.
xgovernmentcars.com.
So, like I said, I've toured this area a couple of times over the years, Casa Grande and some of the other. There's a whole bunch. There are probably 13, 14 pretty amazing sites in Arizona alone. And then you get into New Mexico and Southern Arizona, you know, way down by the border, there's a whole bunch of all kinds of really cool things. So I've toured some of them over time, and it's haunting. And a lot of it is trying to figure out what happened to those people. Now, I guess you could say that first, their descendants are all over this region and in many different tribes of Native Americans. Second, the experts really aren't sure what happened, but it was probably a combination of things. You know, I'll give you the rundown. I did kind of earlier, but I'll do it again. Archaeologists think the area entered a wet period in which there were many, many storms and lots of rain. Now, this part of the country usually gets rains twice a year, late summer, early fall, and then spring. And they don't get a lot of rain, so hence the irrigation from the Salt and Gila rivers. But during the mid-1400s, or getting close to the mid-1400s, and this is cyclical, so what happened was it entered a period of heavy rains, and it swamped their irrigation system, which was the first problem. Native history says that their leader was assassinated, at least that's one story, and that the people there demanded that the assassin be found, and then this started a war. Sounds kind of familiar. People began to flee then for two reasons. First, the irrigation, and thus the farming problem, and then perhaps some kind of war. They also speculate there might have been disease or malnutrition as the result of other kinds of problems. So, like the other theory is that, like the Aztecs and the Inca, which created these what some archaeologists view as urban societies, they grew too large for the agricultural base as it existed at the time. So the agricultural technology they had simply could not support life to the degree to which it had grown. And that, I'm sure, a lot of bikers out here. That, I'm sure, in the context of the time, put a lot of pressure on leadership and on the way that their little society or big society, because we don't know how many there were, was organized. And, you know, you'll hear people talk about that when it comes to the Aztecs and the Incas. And of course, there's always the conspiracy theories on YouTube and so forth about how it was aliens and, you know, this kind of nonsense. I think it's probably a combination of things. And I've heard that theory, and I heard that theory today as well, that it's a combination of things. But either way, over a relatively short period of time, the whole region basically depopulated. Now, I love history. And what's cool about this part of the country is, you know, I love American history, but this is American history that's not United States history. This is a prehistoric, if you will, group of people. I don't like the term prehistoric because there is a history. It's mostly oral history among the Indians, and there are artifacts and there's things. When I think prehistory, prehistoric, I think of dinosaurs. That's not what this is. This is just a large, if you will, society of people that lived out here and perhaps all over North America that we know very, very little about. And that's what makes it really, really interesting. And yeah, there were a lot of people in North America back in those days from at least, 1,000 on and maybe even back longer and at least until the 1400s. There, in fact, there's a lot of arguments, you know, concerning 1492 and the arrival of Columbus in the New World, obviously nowhere near Massachusetts or New York State or any place like that. That came later, but they think there were a lot more Indians. Some people think that there were a lot more Indians, so-called Indians. I hate calling them Indians because that's our name for them. Whatever they called themselves, there may have been a lot of them here. But that's a bone of contention. Some think that there were much, much higher numbers across North America, Central America, and South America. Others disagree. And then each of those gives way to theories about what happened to them and whether it was disease, starvation, you know, wars, all sorts of different things. So it's a great subject for history and a big bone of contention, and it has a huge impact on what we think was here because, you know, I was raised with the idea that this is a big wide open space and nobody was out here. And, you know, I cling to that idea because I'm a typical, white American who was raised in Chicago in the belly of the industrial beast, and, you know, you thought of the West as being empty. But there were a lot of people out here, and I think it's interesting because the descendants of these people and others are scattered all over this place, just as the descendants of the Celts and other prehistoric European tribes are scattered all over Europe and the world. And you wonder what happened. You always wonder what happened. And, of course, in Europe, we have some kind of history, a little bit more, primarily because of Rome, because Rome transmitted the written word to the church primarily. So you had the church keeping some kinds of records. And then I think probably more records existed from Rome than perhaps existed from this society as here. And I don't know that this society, and I use those terms lightly because, again, that's also debatable. Some people refuse to call it a culture or a society. I don't know what you want to call it. But I don't think they rose to the level of Rome. But then, if you want to go off onto the conspiracy theories, maybe they came from Asia. Maybe they came from a high society that existed sometime beyond the pale in the fog of history, where it really is prehistoric in that it precedes this Earth age going back more than 10,000 years. What if they're descendants of the Atlanteans? You know, what if they're descendants of the Hollow Earth people? You know, I'm not saying I really don't believe in the Hollow Earth theory, but you never know. So what happened becomes a really interesting question that you think about in relation to the current time that we live in, because we are now at a time when we focus on something that we feel is earth-shattering. We call it a presidential election, but if you look at it in the distance of time, it's kind of pithy, quite honestly. And I'm not saying it isn't important. It's important to us, but it is good to look back at a people who were simply dispersed without explanation. And we don't know what happened to them. We have theories. We have stories handed down through generations. We also, you know, this kind of provokes this question of what is going to happen to us? What are we going to be the stewards of? Are we going to be looking back, or is some future person going to be looking back, like in the Planet of the Apes, on ruins of our culture that are simply a mystery? Like, for example, they don't know what the second and third stories of the Roman buildings were used for, because none of them survived. We know they had them, but we don't know what they used them. We do not know very much at all about the religions of the Roman Empire. We know what was transmitted to the Catholic Church. We know that there are elements of Mithraism that were transmitted to the Catholic Church. So some of the ceremonies of the church are perhaps pagan, which is very interesting to me. But we don't know very much about ancient Rome's customs, other than theories and things that were handed down to the books that we have, like Tacitus, for example, and the writings of people like Cato. But we don't know, going back further than those guys, hundreds of years before those guys, we don't know what some of the things that we know existed were actually used for. So, you know, that's fascinating. Well, I wonder if that's going to be what it's like with us someday. And if we want to avoid that, is there going to be a clean line of history dating back to our time in 300 or 400 years? Because if there is, then the question is whether it's going to be objective history or some kind of fairy tale. And you can make fun of people who tell stories in oral form, which have taken the form of, you know, myth, like the Western myth, like Wyatt Earp. But that's how a culture and a history is transmitted. What are we up to these days that can have devastating results that we don't know could have devastating results? You know, things that we're doing that we're not aware of. And by the way, I'm not talking about global warming. I'm not talking about pollution. I'm not talking about that kind of stuff. I'm talking about the stuff that we really don't even want to know about. Maybe something that might be referred to as the unseen hand, things that you do consciously or unconsciously that sabotages you as an individual or as a people, and what you don't know that you don't know, right? Because we don't know anything about the individual ho-ho-cum, maybe a little. We know what might have happened to them, and I wonder whether someday people will be looking at us thinking, you know, we don't know what they did with these big steel structures, these giant things that are still around, or what these metal things were for, because, you know, the chips inside of our computers and everything will turn back into sand. You know, that's not going to last 500-600 years, maybe, but I doubt that it will work in 500 or 600 years. So they're going to struggle to figure out what we were all about 500 or 600 years from now. And that is why it is good to tour these sites in the midst of something insane like the shout fest going on in media right now about this presidential election. This is why it is good to get out and tour these sites, to get out of yourself and out of the insanity and what I would just actually call the silliness that passes for daily discussion of something as trivial and as important to us as a presidential election. So, you know, I'm not denying that these things are important. I'm just saying that we can, you know, raise them to mythical status sometimes in a way that is just ridiculous, because we have the luxury of being able to know at least that human beings can be very advanced for their day, and in a few short centuries, screw the pooch. Is that what we're doing right now? By the way, I just want to say thanks for the donations to Mobile Podcast Command, because it's going directly into my PayPal for diesel fuel and Komodo Dragon and, you know, stuff like paying for the RV place to plug in so I can do these podcasts. And a lot of people have been making contributions, and I really, really appreciate it. If you want to do this, all you got to do is scroll down to the donate window. It takes you to PayPal, to the donate window for me. You can fill that thing out and put in $5, $50, $500, $5,000, whatever you want to put in there, and it comes right to the PayPal account, and then I can use it on the road, and I really, really appreciate that. And of course, thanks xgovernmentcars.com, the ancestral father of Mobile Podcast Command. Don't forget xgovernmentcars.com takes trades. They can help you get a loan. They have a 3-day love it guarantee. They are now open in Golden Valley at 2420 Nevada Avenue North. xgovernmentcars.com.
xgovernmentcars.com.
Now, look, before the below zero thing starts, and it's not going to take long. I mean, I know it goes Thanksgiving, we get the first sleet in the real snow, usually, and it starts to get cold. And then by the time we get to Christmas, we're below zero. You really should get your heating checked because it's about efficiency and it's going to save you money. And Ryan Plumbing and Heating of St. Paul can do it, and they can help you save money by making some suggestions. 651-224-4771 in Minneapolis, 612-927-6488 online at ryanplumbing.com. Emergency service, and have your heating checked metro-wide from St. Paul. That, of course, means the suburbs, too. So we're talking Golden Valley. We're talking West St. Paul, all over the place. For four generations, quality replacement and repair of all plumbing, heating, and air conditioning systems, residential and business. I can't emphasize that enough because they do a lot of business stuff. Ryan Plumbing and Heating. So I passed this town, which was and it was in the Phoenix area while we were out cruising around. This whole town was for pilots to has a runway behind the houses, and the pilots can land and put their planes in a hangar and live there. Very cool. And so if you're a pilot and you want to get back home to your neighborhood with the runway down the back between the houses, you want to be safe when you do it. And you want to be safe on takeoffs and landings. And Alpha Systems helps you do that because their motto is helping pilots fly safe. They make the revolutionary angle of attack indicator. Why is it revolutionary? Well, general aviation generally does not have visual indicators of lift underneath the airplane. And the biggest problem in general aviation is this final turn to land where pilots lose lift and then there's no time to correct. So this is a visual indicator of the amount of lift under your airplane and how much power you have to add to keep it from falling out of the sky, right? Bottom line is Alpha saves lives with their angle of attack indicator, and their motto again is pilots fly safe. Click on the Alpha Systems banners at the top of the Bob Davis podcast page for more info about Alpha's revolutionary angle attack indicator. It takes you to their page. A lot of content and info on there about the stuff I'm talking about, and it is right there at the top of the page at thebobdavispodcasts.com. Now, thank you for listening on Stitcher.com, iTunes, TuneIn, liking, sharing, favoriting, and following on Facebook and Twitter, and of course Instagram, which I love. I'm at the Bob Davis Podcasts on Twitter. I am Bob Davis Podcast on Instagram, and the Bob Davis Podcasts on YouTube, which I've just initiated. Didn't make any videos today, but when I do make a video, I'm throwing it up on YouTube because the quality is better than the quality on Facebook. So just keep that in mind. And again, thanks for checking the channel out and subscribing and giving me ideas about what to do with YouTube. Love it. And I also appreciate your donations for Mobile Podcast Command that you can make right on the site there. Just click on the big yellow donate button at thebobdavispodcast.com. One more thing. Thanks for listening to the stream on thebobdavispodcast.com. Lots of people finding the ongoing audio stream, which plays the last three podcasts. I really appreciate that. I think the stream is super cool. It's high quality. It's loud. You can use it on your smartphone or on the desktop. So thanks again. And thanks for listening to podcast 565, Casa Grande.